tonight in Luke 23, we want to look at Jesus before both Pilate and Herod, Jesus' condemnation, His crucifixion, and maybe we'll get to the burial this evening as well. But Luke chapter 23, Jesus was brought at the end of 22, is brought before the council, and a smaller group, they condemn Him. But then the next morning, then the assembly rose as a body and brought Jesus before Pilate. So they've come together, they have decided as a whole group, the whole council of the Sanhedrin, not just a few, to have Jesus killed. Well, they've got to come up with something before the Romans, because blasphemy against God and the law of Moses, Romans don't care about that. What they care about is treason. So since blasphemy doesn't work, they decide Jesus has to be charged with treason or sedition. And there are actually three charges that they will use here in the Gospel of Luke. Gospel of Mark in chapter 15 says he was brought before Pilate on charges. But here in Luke, Luke specifies three. Each one of them could be seen in one way or another as sowing the seeds of treason or sedition against Rome. So they began to accuse him. This is in front of Pilate. Now, Pilate was a rather ruthless guy. And that's more than he wasn't married to somebody named Ruth. But he was rather ruthless in the way he treated people. He got his jollies off of being cruel. Pilate was an early riser. There are some who say that in addition to being an early riser, that, well, there was a reason he was, to get things over with so then he could go out and just kind of relax and ride horses and do whatever else he wanted to do. But usually his court met sometime just after daybreak until about mid-morning, and then he took off for the rest of the day to do whatever he wanted to do or needed to do. So it's early in the morning. They get up. They have Jesus before Pilate rather soon, and estimates are different as to how large a crowd would have been. Sometimes it'd be a large crowd, especially if there was a high-profile case that was going to go before Pilate and a lot of folks wanted to come and see. Sometimes it would be smaller. We really don't know the size of the crowd, but it's enough to where Pilate gets worried about a possible riot and what that might mean. So they take him there and they say, "We found him perverting our nation, forbidding us to pay taxes to the emperor, and saying that he himself is the Messiah, a king." Now, here we've got the religious leaders, and as I say here on the outline, Luke, more than any other gospel writer, Luke points a finger at the Jewish leaders and less at the Roman involvement. The Romans are still involved, but he puts more of the blame on the Jewish leaders than he does the Romans. The other writers pretty much let you know, yes, it was the Jewish leaders, but it was also the Roman procurator who was responsible. Each was culpable. But once again, I think Luke, part of Luke's purpose is to show that Christianity is not a politically subversive religion. And if he starts really hammering Pontius Pilate on all of this and the Roman authorities, then it's going to sound like that Christianity and Jesus are politically subversive. And Jesus was a political revolutionary. So here we've got Luke putting more emphasis on the Jewish leaders. And there are those three charges. Perverting the nation, that is, undermining their loyalty to Rome. Forbidding tribute or taxes. One of the ways that you acknowledge Rome's power and Rome's sovereignty over you was to pay your taxes, to pay whatever tribute they asked, even if it was over and above what it might normally be. And when Jesus talked about give to Caesar, they kind of manipulate here, and they forget that he said give to Caesar the things that belong to Caesar and to God the things that belong to God. Pilate doesn't know that. And so they're trying to say that Jesus, in talking about taxes and in saying, yeah, give to Caesar something, but also keep something for you, that is, give it to God, they're trying to say that Jesus is saying, take your taxes and split them and just give the government some of them, give the rest of them to the temple. And that would be seen as denying the absolute sovereignty of Rome. And since Roman emperor worship is in vogue, that's denying the sovereignty of the emperor. But the one that really resonates with Pilate is he himself claims to be Christ, a king. Now, they are interpreting it, as many folks would, the Messiah within Judaism, as a political earthly ruler. They've heard Jesus talk about other things. Jesus has said that his kingdom is not in this world, but this is a convenient way for them to get the Romans to do him in, to make him look like a political revolutionary. Pilate looks at him then and says, okay, are you king of the Jews? Put it to you straightforward. See, that's the only charge he's interested in, not the other two, but the one about claiming to be a king. Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus' response is, well, you've said so. What that means is, those are your words, they're not mine, because he knows what Pilate's pushing toward. Is he a revolutionary? He said, those are your words, they're not mine. And Pilate says, takes that, well, he must be denying that he's a king. It's a statement of denial. So Pilate says to the crowds, I find no basis for accusation against this man. He said, there's no reason to bring him here and accuse him of this. He's not a political revolutionary. He just said he's not a king. However, the leaders don't buy that. Remember, they want to get rid of Jesus because they're worried. It's also interesting that Pilate, on three different occasions throughout this, Pilate will declare that Jesus is innocent of the crime. He tries over and over again to let Jesus off. It's interesting that Pilate, and down here in verses 13 to 25, Pilate becomes kind of the defense attorney in some ways for Jesus. He defends Jesus against the religious leaders and even against himself when he says, this man's innocent. And then later again he'll say, I don't find any reason to condemn this man. He's innocent of these charges. But the leaders say he's a threat. He's a threat. He stirs up the people by teaching throughout all Judea from Galilee, where he began, even to this place. In other words, the whole land. He goes through teaching people not to do this. Well, when Pilate hears, and we know here in verses 6 and following, when Pilate hears that Jesus is from Galilee, he thinks he can kill two birds with one stone. Because Herod, this is Herod Antipas, the same one that had John the Baptizer beheaded, Herod is the tetrarch over Galilee. His authority is in Galilee to rule on behalf of Rome. And as long as he kind of keeps his nose clean in that area, he and Pilate are not going to butt heads. But there have been some occasions, and some of the Roman historians and Flavius Josephus indicate that Pilate and Herod Antipas had butted heads over a few things, and they really didn't like each other. And so he said, ah, this man's from Galilee. Well, that means he needs to go to Herod. And he learns that Herod is in Jerusalem because it is what? Passover. So he's come to Jerusalem for that. The Herods, by the way, while they were Jewish, Herod the Great, they were Jewish by religion. They were actually Idumean by birth, which is a Gentile. It's a loose cousin, but on the Gentile side. So they're actually more Hellenistic Jews. And so, you know, they would come oftentimes to Jerusalem, and especially during special holy days, just to kind of show themselves and let people, you know, remember who they are and all this kind of stuff. So Herod's here and he says, tell you what, take him to Herod. If he's a Galilean, that's Herod's jurisdiction. Let Herod deal with it. Well, what happens if Herod, we've mentioned this before in some venues, what happens if Herod, whose authority is only in Galilee, pronounces Jesus guilty as worthy of death in Jerusalem, in Judea? What do you think would happen? Pontius Pilate's looking at this. Galilee is in the north. Judea and Jerusalem are in the south. Herod's jurisdiction is in the north, not in the south. What happens if Herod, who is now down in the south, says, yeah, he needs to die, go ahead and kill him right here at Passover? Absolutely, Robert. It'll be trouble. Trouble for Herod. Pilate can contact the authorities in Rome and say, look, this guy's trying to take over more power than we've given him. Told you he's nothing but trouble. So he gets to not only get rid of Jesus and the religious leaders off his back, But he potentially can get rid of Herod Antipas and then appoint somebody he can get along with in Galilee. So he sends him over to Herod. And we're told here, this is the second time that Herod has wanted to see Jesus. So he sends him over there. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had been wanting to see him for a long time because he had heard about him and was hoping to see what? A miracle. Walk across my swimming pool. Oh, wait, that was in Jesus Christ Superstar. But that was, yeah, walk across this pond, turn some stones into bread, you know, something. Heal somebody. Do something that's a miracle. Prove to me that you're not a fool, that you really are Messiah, and I'll follow you. He didn't think Jesus could do that anyway. So, here he goes. Pilate says, well, I'm going to send you off to Herod. But Jesus refuses. If Jesus had performed a miracle, he kind of gets himself off the hook. And he gets Herod backing him. But Jesus is not about to use this opportunity to avoid death. He questioned him at some length, but Jesus gave him no answer. Of course, the miracle might be, not only here, but later on, the miracle might be the fact that Jesus kept his mouth shut. I mean, how would you feel if people were mocking you and doing all this kind of stuff? It'd be tough to keep your mouth shut, right? But he says nothing. So the chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him. And they're not just bringing papers. They're screaming and hollering accusations at him and demanding that Herod do something. But Herod says, this man's not dangerous. And Herod says, probably says in the back of his, if I were Herod, knowing that Pilate sent him here and I'm out of my jurisdiction, I'd be thinking this was a setup. All Jesus has to do is speak up and he can save himself, but he doesn't. So Herod sees him as insignificant, just a frustrated revolutionary whose things have gone bad. And he and his soldiers mock Jesus, beat Jesus, put him in an elegant robe. Elegant robe would have either been white or purple. Robe, signs of royalty. And send him back. Send him back to Pilate, saying, I don't find him guilty. I'm not going to condemn him. And when the text says that same day Herod and Pilate became friends with each other, before this had been enemies, they didn't really become friends. They weren't bosom buddies. They didn't go fishing together. If they'd gone hunting together, neither one of them would have been watching for the game. They would have been watching each other. What it means is they had an understanding of what was going on, so they just kind of they treated each other cordially when they had to, and otherwise they stayed out of each other's way. Pilate then called together the chief priests and the leaders of the people and said to them, "You brought me this man as one who was perverting the people, and here I have examined him in your presence, haven't found him guilty of any of your charges. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. He's done nothing to deserve death. Therefore, I will have him flogged." The word's also sometimes translated chastised. "And release him." Pilate offers to chastise Jesus. It's interesting, as I note here in Luke, the two people who have the authority, who really have the authority to do something on behalf of the Romans, are the two people that say he's innocent. Pilate and Herod Antipas. Whereas the Sanhedrin is trying to condemn him, and the laws of the Sanhedrin, which they broke, say that no one can be condemned unless two witnesses corroborate every detail. I could go over to the office and pull a book off the shelf that's got the laws of the Sanhedrin concerning trials in it. There have to be two witnesses to corroborate. So it's kind of, I think, I'll say here, it's kind of ironic that they needed two witnesses to condemn him and they couldn't come up with two to condemn him. And the two authorities, Herod Antipas and Pilate, both witness that he's not guilty of any crime worthy of death. The best laid plans of mice and men. So he says, I'm going to chastise or my translation says flog, which is probably the better translation, because chastising could be smacking him on the back of the hand and scold him, don't you dare do this again, up to actually scourging. And that's what takes place, as we know, is the scourging. So he says, I'll do this and turn him loose. But they all shouted out, away with this fellow, release Barabbas for us. This was a man who had been put in prison for an insurrection that had taken place in the city and for murder. So here we go. They're asking them to turn loose somebody who actually was guilty of the same charges that they brought Jesus up on. And Jesus isn't guilty. And so the religious leaders, as Luke pushes it, and the rest of the crowd that's there get caught up in the moment. Crowd or mob violence, mob mentality. They get caught up in the moment and they say, no, no, we want this guy. Now, who would, Pilate is shocked, because who would you rather have out on the street? The guy that you know is out there doing no good and stealing and cutting and beating and killing, or the guy that walks around talking about compassion and grace and mercy and helping people? Most normal folks would want Jesus out on the street, even if they didn't know he was Messiah, and not Barabbas. But they start screaming for Barabbas. And Pilate, wanting to release Jesus, addressed them again, but they kept shouting, crucify him, crucify him. And a third time he said to them, why? What evil has he done? I found in him no ground for the sentence of death. Tell you what, I'll have him flogged and release him. And that's not good enough. In fact, they begin screaming so loudly to crucify him, they're probably drawing bystanders in that are going down the streets, coming in to see, and of course they get caught up in it all. And Pilate is charged, among other things, Pilate is charged with keeping peace on behalf of Rome. What happens if they riot? There's a massacre, and word gets back to Rome, Pilate could be out of a job. Pilate could be in big trouble. He could even end up in prison, but at least demoted. And so when Pontius Pilate, who doesn't want to turn Jesus over, when he finally gives in, Pilate is looking out for himself. This is a case of self-preservation. Plain and simple. A case of self-preservation on behalf of Pilate. And so he gives in. I liked this quote from Charles Talbert. When he talks about, you know, we tend to push people and we tend to talk about how evil the religious leaders were and how terrible Pilate was and all this kind of stuff. He says, the contemporary meaning of the cross is a judgment on the evil of all humanity. For centuries, men have deftly avoided the implications of the cross by a very simple maneuver. They place the blame for the murder of Jesus on the Jews. The truth is that they were people who did this. They were people just like all people, with the same ambitions, the same weaknesses, the same problems. Instead of coming to terms with the Word of God, they decided to silence a disturbing word or disturbing voice that proclaimed it. We also try to push God out of His world, take it over for ourselves, and use it for our own ambitions. What Talbert is saying in looking at this, he said, you know, if we really look at it and we think about it, how much different are we really? We've got the benefit of hindsight. We've got the benefit of history. But in a lot of areas, how much different are we than the Jewish leaders or the crowds or even the Roman procurator that gave in self-preservation? Caiaphas, the high priest, would have known about the prophecies concerning Messiah, but in his estimation, Messiah is, you know, while they would hope for it, for him to set up an earthly political kingdom, if it comes at this time, it very well may be inconvenient for the religious leadership. He did know, but their idea of those prophecies and the way they interpreted them were different from the way the New Testament writers understood the prophecies to come true. It's just like in the suffering servant passages in Isaiah. For most of the Jewish folks, and especially the religious leaders, the suffering servant was not an individual who was Messiah, but the suffering servant was the corporate nation of Israel that suffered on behalf of God and would rule and reign someday. It's a very good question, but that's how he would have looked at that. So Jesus is sentenced to death. As they led him away, they seized a man, Simon of Cyrene, sometimes pronounced Cyrene, who was coming from the country, and they laid the cross on him and made him carry it behind Jesus. A great number of the people followed him, and among them were women who were beating their breasts and wailing for him. But, you know, Jesus turns and tells them they shouldn't be weeping for him. They should be weeping for themselves, O daughters of Jerusalem, and weeping for their children. Cyrene was in northern Africa, had a large Jewish population. Later on, we find that his sons are mentioned, and they were probably well known there, and they're mentioned in the book of Acts as well. They were probably well known in the Christian church. Simon, most scholars think that Simon became a follower sometime after this event. He started listening to, he's forced to carry this crossbeam, and this man's crucified. And later on, he probably wanted to know more about what all took place, and listening to the disciples in Jerusalem and in other places, probably became a disciple. But what's really interesting is there is no disciple there to carry this crossbeam. This stranger, Simon, does so. But I can't help but remember when Simon is carrying this cross behind Jesus. He is bearing his cross, that is Jesus' cross. I can't help but remember the times that Jesus says that we should take up our cross and bear it. We should take up the cross and follow him. Simon, though he didn't fully understand what that meant, he didn't understand what was going on here. Simon is, for Luke, Simon the Cyrenian is kind of the prototype physically for this person who spiritually also picks up the cross and carries it. He bears the cross of Jesus when all those who said, including Simon Peter, "I'll never deny you, I'll die before I deny you," have run off and hidden. Simon the Cyrenian, who bears this cross, later becomes a Christian because of that experience with Jesus in bearing the cross. I've seen some paintings in the past of, I can't remember, it's been a probably 15 years ago I saw a painting, can't remember right now where it was, and I thought, it was in a store. I said, I might buy that, and then, of course, I didn't, and about a month later, they said, oh, it's not being printed anymore. But it had Simon and Jesus both carrying the crossbeam together. And you could see the pain etched in Jesus' face and the concern on Simon's face. Not for himself, but the concern, the look on his face was concern for Jesus, this man that he was helping. Not fully understanding why it was happening or what he was doing, but still there was that concern, which kind of talks about this whole thing of empathy and compassion and mercy for someone, even though you may not fully understand who they are or from where they come. The women cry out, and basically they cry out just like a funeral procession would be. They're wheeling. They're weeping and wailing. So I guess that's true. They're wheeling. They're weeping and wailing together. But there, some translations say that they bewailed and lamented, beating their chests. When a funeral procession took place, yes, the words are different, some of the meanings are different, but you see these people on the TV in the Middle East with funeral processions, and the women are screaming and then making other words and all this kind of stuff and other sounds. That's typical of the funeral procession, and pouring one's soul out and one's heart out in moaning and weeping and wailing. But that's generally done as the procession is going along after the person's dead, right? These women are crying out before Jesus dies. They know what the outcome is going to be, but they are crying out. And some scholars think these among them would have been the women who had followed him from Galilee to Jerusalem, weeping even before he dies, wailing even before he dies, asking God to have mercy. Asking God to have mercy. And Jesus looks at them and says, you know, if you really understood how important this is, what's taking place, you wouldn't be crying for me. You'd be crying for yourself. You'd be crying for a world that needs repentance. In fact, Jesus' answer here, for the days are surely coming when they will say, blessed are the barren and the wounds that never bore and the breasts that never nursed. Then they will begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. For if they do this when the wood is green, what will happen when it's dry? They do it now when there is life being offered. What's going to happen later on? Jesus is actually offering to them a call to repent. A call to repent. Those who are killing him and those who are just the bystanders that are caught up in the moment. A call to repent. As they go, we know that there were two criminals. We've read this so many times. There were two criminals that go and they are crucified alongside him. Crucifixion, notice I put not, the misspelling that I often see. It grates on me when people misspell crucifixion and they spell it as if it were F-I-C-T-I-O-N, as if it were fiction. So it's crucifixion, C-R-U-C-I-F-I-X-I-O-N, not C-R-U-C-I-F-I-C-T-I-O-N. It is anything but fiction. That's just my little way I get, but I have, over the years of teaching, I cannot count the number of times that people spell it that way. It was borrowed from the Phoenicians and the Persians. The Romans didn't invent it. The Phoenicians, those folks that gave us a phonic alphabet and a horrible way to kill people. The average time is very barbaric. The average time on a cross was 12 to 18 hours, though Flavius Josephus, after the fall of Jerusalem, writes that he came through 3 days later and found two of his friends still alive that had been crucified. You're hanging there suffocating for all of that period of time. Extremely barbaric and slow way to die, potentially. Jesus' first utterance from the cross, though, in the middle of all of this, and everybody's, or most everybody's mocking him, is to pray. In fact, as we've said numerous times before, the two prayers that Jesus begins and ends his time on the cross with, according to Luke, are basically the same two prayers flip-flopped that Stephen, as he is stoned and dies, prays. First Christian martyr. It's a prayer for those who are crucifying him. Even the soldiers who are gambling for his robe, he's praying for them. And not just those that are crucifying him, but for everybody who needs his redemption. For the times that perhaps we may have wondered or belittled something about Jesus or about redemption. Or the times other people do. He's praying for all of us because we all are in that need. He says, Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing. Not only these here, Jesus is also praying for the religious leaders who have pushed him to have him killed. He's praying for Pontius Pilate, who doesn't understand why this is going on. He's praying for his disciples and the women, and he's praying for you and me when we have times that we really do things and we don't understand what we're doing. As the people watch this, the rulers scoff at Jesus. You know, the life that he lived was not enough to prove who he was. So now they want him to prove it while he's up there. People stood by watching. The leader scoffed at him, saying, oh, he saved others. Let him save himself if he's the Messiah of God, the chosen one. Come on down. Save yourself. If you're the Son of God, if he is the Messiah of God. Anybody heard that phrase applied anywhere else in the Gospels? If you're the Son of God. That's right. Yeah, the devil is tempting as a temptation. If you're the Son of God, then prove it. Do this. If you're the Son of God, prove it. Do this. They're saying the same thing. This is kind of also Luke's way of saying that that at least for the short run right here, it seems that the powers of darkness, the same powers of darkness that tried him early in his ministry, right now are trying him again. If he came down off the cross, what does that do? What if Jesus had come down off the cross? What does that do? Yeah, that negates what he preached. That negates our redemption. That also says that the powers of darkness win. When Jesus doesn't give in, the powers of darkness don't win. It might look like it sometimes, but they don't. That's what Luke is indicating also here, is that, you know, Jesus is not only praying, but he's not going to prove his power. Because if he does, at their request, it negates what he's been teaching and what he's done. The soldiers mock him. They offer him vinegar, some translations say. Some say soured wine. Actually, the wine that was given to the poorest people in Palestine, or they would get hold of stuff that was being thrown out because it was right before changing from wine to vinegar. Here, Jesus is being mocked, and the only piece of humanity in the middle of this inhumane situation is to give him the wine that's about to become vinegar that the poorest people find. That's further mockery, saying he's even more insignificant in their minds than he might seem to be. Yeah, he's a frustrated, defeated revolutionary. Remember last time we talked about how Pilate said, you know, "Is this? Who is this guy? Who is he?" The penitent criminal speaks against his friend. We've got the story of the two thieves, the two criminals, and one of them gets caught up in the. I guess he needs to take his mind off of things, and if Jesus has the power, you know, get me down from here too, whatever you do to yourself. He gets caught up in the mob, and he says, "If you're really the Son of God, what, save yourself and us." The emphasis is on "and us." Notice this, but his friend, we all know what his friend says. "You know, we deserve this. What are you doing? He's an innocent man. We deserve this." And then he looks at Jesus, and he says, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your," we often translate it kingdom, but it's also the word means kingly power. Kingly power. That is, at the judgment. At this point, this man believes he's come. It's an expression of his belief that Jesus is going to have something to do with the judgment. So he says, "Jesus, remember me. Just think about me when you come into your kingly power." And Jesus says to him, he doesn't, I mean, a lot of us might, if we weren't Messiah, we might say, "Yeah, right. You fend for yourself." Jesus, once again, shows compassion. He says, "Truly I tell you, today you will be with me in paradise." Now, in the Greek text, you can put the comma either place because it's not a comma. There's not a comma in the Greek text. And you can put it either place. "Truly I tell you today, comma, you'll be with me in paradise." In other words, I'm telling you today that sometime out there you will be. Or, "Truly I tell you, comma, today you will be with me in paradise." It can be translated either way, and I know a lot of folks that go the other way with it, and a lot of folks that go this way with it. I think that the comma is better before the word "today." Because in order to reach paradise, what do we have to do? Yeah, we have to die. Death, which seems like the ultimate defeat, is actually the means by which we get into God's glory. Or we enter into paradise. God's glory. Paradise, by the way, or heaven, is actually a Hellenistic term that was used predominantly to describe a place of comfort, a place of serenity, a place that was pleasant and lacked pain in Hellenistic circles. "Truly I tell you, today you'll be with me in paradise. He knows they're both going to die, and the only way this man can enter paradise is through death, but also the way that Jesus is going to enter into paradise and welcome folks is not by coming down off the cross and taking off on a cloud. It's not by getting on a bike and saying, E.T. phone home. But it's by dying. If Jesus' death was not real, then we've got no hope. We've got no hope. But it's through death, the prerequisite into paradise. Luke then tells us that there are two kind of strange events that happen. It's about noon, and darkness came over the whole land until 3 PM, while the sun's light failed. Cosmic significance to this death. At that point in time, there's darkness. Whether it's a tremendous cloud that doesn't go away, whether it's an eclipse of the sun, or whether it's just darkness. Just as in the birth of Jesus there were cosmic ramifications, so here there are cosmic ramifications, cosmic meaning. And secondly, the curtain of the temple, that which separated people in the temple, is torn in two. Some scholars say what that means is that Jesus has opened the way for man to God in a new fashion. Some interpret it as saying God's judgment is coming on temple worship. That doesn't mean the form, but that means the worship of the temple over and above, and the worship of the rituals over and above relationship with God. Jesus' final words, Father, into your hands I commit my spirit, and then he breathed his last. Those words are once again a connection with God and a dying with confidence. Dying with confidence. Dying with trust. When Jesus died in such a fashion, the centurion had seen people die in all kinds of ways. He'd seen people crucified and had seen them die in horrible ways and with horrible screams and horrible things on their lips. The text says, when the centurion, and this is a centurion that's over 100 men that supervises the crucifixion of Jesus. When the centurion saw this, what had taken place, he praised God and said, certainly, this man was innocent. Roman centurion doesn't fully understand what's going on here, but he recognizes in the way Jesus died. He recognizes in just the time that he watched the religious leaders and everything else that took place, but he recognized in the way Jesus died that this man wasn't guilty of anything except having compassion, except showing mercy, except giving himself over for others. So once again, we've got the Roman procurator Pilate saying three times Jesus is innocent. We've got Herod Antipas saying Jesus is innocent. And we've got the Roman centurion saying Jesus is innocent. Those who would be the least likely to recognize him declare him as innocent. But all his acquaintances, including the women who had followed him from Galilee, stood at a distance watching these things. There are some scholars, the women are there, they followed to the place of the burial. There are some scholars that think, since Gnosticism, with that Gnostic Redeemer, that ghost figure, was so rampant at the time Luke was writing, that perhaps this is Luke's way of kind of giving an anti-Gnostic polemic or argument, saying, listen, there were people there who saw him die, and these women, not just the men who killed him, but these women who had followed him saw him die. They saw where he was buried, and they went back and they saw him out of the tomb and alive. Well, the Gnostic said that the spirit man couldn't die, and the spirit man would never come in the flesh. And so here Luke, who is educated and who's well aware of Gnosticism and Gnostic Christians, is arguing the point that Jesus, even the Roman centurion, recognizes him as innocent, as different. Jesus, as Son of God, does inhabit a physical form. Jesus, as Son of God, does get crucified. Jesus as Son of God does die, and then in chapter 24, Jesus as Son of God is resurrected. The last part here, verses 50 through 56a, because actually, on the Sabbath day they rested according to the commandment, but on the first day of the week, at early dawn, they came to the tomb, taking the spices and ointment they had prepared. Actually is part of the same verse. We just kind of divided it up differently in the way everything goes when the text was divided. Now, there was a good and righteous man named Joseph who, though a member of the council, had not agreed to their plan. He came from the Jewish town of Arimathea, and he was waiting expectantly for the kingdom of God. I actually had a student one time early in my teaching career when we were talking about Joseph of Arimathea, and I was asking, anybody know what Joseph of Arimathea did? No, I was asking, did anybody know what he did, as in not donating here, but what his profession was? Well, he was a member of the Sanhedrin. He was a wealthy man. That's what we know. But I had somebody say that he taught Arimathea. He taught math, arithmetic. So then I would use that sometimes as an example. Said, you know, this guy Joseph, he was counting up exactly what it was going to get him to do this. But yeah, they did. They thought he had something to do with math. He was a mathematician. No, he wasn't. He's from the town of Arimathea. And he comes in. He is a member of the Sanhedrin. And it's interesting, when nobody else is there to take Jesus' body, Joseph cares for the body of Jesus. Now, we are told he was not in agreement with the decision, but the majority voted to do this to Jesus. He requests the body. We're told that he's good toward his fellow man and righteous toward God. By the way, those are two of the qualities for deacons in the book of Acts. He requests the body in part because he's good and righteous, and maybe in part because if you go to law in Deuteronomy, it says you're not supposed to curse be anyone who hangs on a tree, but you're also not supposed to leave the body hanging on a tree, especially when it comes time for Sabbath. And guess what? Sabbath begins at sundown, which is about 6 o'clock. So Joseph is a caring and righteous person who is a secret follower of Jesus, if you could really be a secret follower, but he's a secret follower of Jesus. Didn't vote with the council. He wants to take care of Jesus' body, but he also wants to get Jesus' body off that cross and buried somewhere so it doesn't desecrate the Sabbath. So he's a good, righteous, and religious man here. And so the body is given. In fact, he goes to Pilate to ask for the body. So he takes a chance. Pilate might say, oh, well, you're a follower of his. Maybe we ought to do you in too. But he takes it down, wraps it in a linen cloth, which would have been wrapped this way and then this way, and places it in a tomb where no one had ever been laid. First body, only body. It was a day of preparation, and the Sabbath was beginning. The day of preparation was Friday before the Sabbath begins. By preparation, it means they're preparing their meals and they're preparing everything else for the beginning of the Sabbath. The women certify that Jesus is dead. They verify he's dead. They go all the way to the tomb. They see how and where his body is laid, and then they return to prepare spices and ointments, and on the Sabbath, they rested. Everybody that went home that night thought it was over and done with. Disciples are in hiding, but they think it's over and done with, and what in the world are we going to do now? Some of them say later on, let's go fishing. Pilate goes to bed that night thinking it's over. The religious leaders think it's over, except for one possibility, according to Matthew. What if his disciples come and steal the body? These big bad guys that have been in hiding are going to come and steal the body out from under the nose of Roman and temple guards. Yeah, I don't think so. The women went home thinking it's over. They got everything together so they can come back after the Sabbath is over and properly prepare the body. Everybody thought it was over and done with. And so the doom and gloom hit, and hit very hard that evening as everyone went home. And from sundown Friday, probably till close to mid-morning on Sunday by the time everybody finally got the word. But at least from sundown Friday until early Sunday morning, the world was awfully dark. And they thought the light had been extinguished. We have the good fortune of knowing almost a couple thousand years later that there was more to the story than that. But imagine, if you would, being among those folks. Even though you've heard Jesus say all this, you've seen the life go out of him. You've seen him buried. What that day and a half must have been. Dr. Tom will be here next week. I was going to have him finish up, but a couple of folks have said, you need to finish it up final Sunday in this month. So Dr. Tom will do something else next Sunday night. He may even talk about resurrection, but we'll finish up the last chapter of Luke later. Hope you have a good night. Thank you for coming and for being here and for your question, Ariel, your responses, Robert and others. And God bless you. Go in peace. Amen.